good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to the other side of midnight. That kind of magical time between dusk and dawn where, you know, the stuff we look at in daytime on CNN or Fox or wherever, and we say, oh, come on, give me a break. When you approach it at this time of night, it's always had a special Elan. And I don't mean Elon Musk, although we are going to talk about Elan later in the show. It's been that kind of subject material where there's the freedom at this time of night to expand our minds, to extend our consciousness, to encompass the ineffable. And my grandmother would wonder why I was saying that word. But, you know, tonight we have a very action-packed show. In fact, this weekend we have two very action-packed shows because, well, I got to start with John Francis. John is our resident naval expert, former officer on the bridge of an Arleigh Burke destroyer. He's been monitoring what's been going on in the Pacific for us, you know, the various elements of the U.S. Navy that can't stop from either running into something or being run into by something. And he has new news tonight on the weird false nuclear alert front in Hawaii. John, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for the introduction. Yeah, it's been quite a week. The main development in this whole false missile alarm in Hawaii was the warning officer, the mystery warning officer, also known as the button pusher.
The button pusher.
He's starting to talk. He went silent there for a while.
Oh.
And he's been on about four or five different radio TV stations in Hawaii. He's got a lawyer now, one of the top lawyers in Hawaii, and I think that's probably why he's speaking. I think it's a good idea that he gets out there and starts telling his side of the story before something unfortunate happens to him, and we don't get to hear it. So I think that was a very wise, proactive step. What we're finding out is some of it corroborates what the official story is and some does not. You know, originally the way he was depicted was as someone with some emotional problems and this and that. And he was primarily designated as the main culprit in this whole scenario.
Well, the story has changed over the last several weeks. Initially, it was that he simply blew it and he hit on this computer screen live, you know, alert as opposed to drill.
Yeah.
Then we find it's a lot more complex.
Yeah.
And then they put out the story that, well, he wasn't really emotionally balanced and he'd made two mistakes before and this was his third. And then, of course, you ask the question, why is the guy still employed in a nuclear alert system?
Yeah.
Don't you want stable people? And now he's talking and we don't have time tonight to go into the full story because in another few days, I'm sure it's going to change again. So we're probably going to have you on for at least first half hour a week from tonight, next Saturday night.
Sounds
and
good.
By then, who knows where the story will have gone. But tune in then because the perils of Pauline in the middle of the Pacific have not ended.
Yeah, it's getting bigger and bigger and it's opening up and it can go in many different directions simultaneously, having a connection with what's going on in North Korea. False flags, possible missile intercepts, and all kinds of scenarios. So it's like it's getting out of control from somebody.
You know, you of course know that old Chinese curse, right? May you live in interesting times.
Correct.
We have all been cursed. Okay, John. We will talk to you next week.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Have a good night. Yeah, I'm listening to this program.
Good night.
Good night.
And welcome back on the other side of midnight on this Saturday night, the 3rd of February. We're already into the second month of the year, 2018. 11 more to go. Can we get through 11 more at the rate at which things are going? Are there going to be 11? I don't want to sound really down, but I mean, tonight we're going to talk about something that I think can change the conversation, and I desperately hope it's going to because we need a game changer. We need something which is going to intervene and get everybody to think in a totally, totally different direction. That's, in fact, why I and my guests tonight have been pursuing what we're going to talk about for the rest of the evening for literally decade after decade after decade. So without further ado, let me introduce my primary guests, because have they got a tale for you? My first guest is an old friend of mine. I mean, I've known Ken for ages and ages and ages. And if he wants to, he can tell the story of how we met. Or if he doesn't want to, he doesn't have to tell the story. But Ken Johnston Sr. is one of four civilian astronaut consultant pilots from the Apollo Moon Program. You remember the Apollo Moon Program? Well, a lot of you actually may not have been born when the Apollo program was underway. Ken is a retired aerospace worker, served as a U.S. Marine, is a well-known NASA whistleblower, and is also well-known because he was witness to history, to NASA image manipulation. We're going to get into a lot of that tonight. And he's going to tell you the story of how he saved an archive of early Apollo-era photos that were original from when Apollo went to the moon to the time before NASA digitized and created an online database of images. And of course, if you're in digital universe, you're in virtual reality, and anything can, and in some cases, has been changed. We're going to talk about that. He used a loophole in the orders he was given decades ago when he was at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. He was told to destroy five sets of 10 by 8 glossy photo prints from the Apollo program. We're talking thousands of photos. And he found a way when he was working at the data and photo control lab at the Lunar Receiving Lab there in Houston during the Apollo missions to save a set for his own records. And decades later, he loaned some of this set to me. And as my grandmother used to say, thereby hangs another tale. His current archive is prized by researchers and lunar anomalies alike because it has been discovered that there has been intentional, systematic, physical, and digital manipulation of the original NASA imagery and the media in order to cover up what was found on the moon and recorded on film and in photos taken by the Apollo astronauts. Ken was born at Fort Sam Houston, Texas in 1942. Grew up in Texas and Oklahoma, and studied at the Oklahoma Military Academy and Oklahoma City University before he enlisted in the military. He enlisted in the Marines, the good old U.S. Marines, in August of 1962, and reported to Pensacola as a Marine Aviation Cadet for flight training in September of 1964. Before Ken left the Marine Corps in 66, he had earned his FAA pilot's license as a single and multi-engine instrument rated flight instructor and was a qualified avionics technician. He was hired by the Grumman Aerospace Corporation that was the principal contractor for the Apollo lunar module. They wrote the book. Well, actually, I wrote the book on the lunar module. That's a whole other story. But they literally created the lunar module, which, of course, took Neil and Buzz down to the surface of the moon in July of 1969. Ken's job at Grumman was to assist with cockpit instrument development and training in Houston, Texas. His title at the time of his hiring was Civilian Astronaut Consultant Pilot. And we have it on the website tonight as Grumman Test Astronaut, because that's what he was. He was basically designed to go where they were going to go afterwards. So, and he'll tell us maybe a couple stories about Neil. While he was there, he assisted in training the astronauts on the use of the systems of the lunar module in a giant vacuum-sealed pressure chamber with launch test Article 8 lunar lander, which was being used as a simulator. Johnson has the record for the most number of hours spent in the LTA-8 simulator, currently now on display at the Smithsonian. And tomorrow night, we're going to have some photos up of Ken standing in front of that lunar module on which he worked to solve all kinds of problems that arose during or might have arisen during the actual missions. Well, you can read all the rest of Ken's biography if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on the guest page tonight. You do that by clicking on the big graphic that says Ken Johnston and Steve Troy. That will take you to the show page. I'm sorry, the guest page. And you scroll down and you will find Ken's bio. Now, my second guest tonight is Steve Troy. Steve is a very interesting guy. I mean, we're going to get into why these guys are so interesting, you know, in the conversation, but let me give you a thumbnail sketch. Steve received his BA liberal arts degree from the University of Iowa in 1968, and in 1983 received his Bachelor of Science in Elementary and Secondary Art Education from Southwest State University in Marshall, Minnesota. He's been an amateur astronomer since 1988, has studied in-depth lunar NASA photography since 1984, and in 1994 he aligned his independent investigations from the traditional models of lunar geology to looking for lunar anomalies, spurred in part by me, I guess, and the Enterprise mission. Steve is often used as a reference person for lunar orbiter and Apollo photography because he's literally been through almost every frame of that damn catalog and the archive that NASA maintains. And we're going to talk about some interesting shifts that took place in that catalog after he began his research. Steve continues to this day to study and document lunar anomalies found on both the near and the far side of the moon. And without further ado, gentlemen, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Thank you for inviting us, Richard. It's been quite a few years, it seems.
Oh, my God. It's been an incredible journey. Steve, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. Okay, Ken, let's go to you first because your tale is anchored in the reality of what in fact was found and then what NASA tried to do to kind of unfind it. But before we get there, kind of expand a bit on how you got into this position. I mean, you've started out, you know, as a Marine, as a pilot. You had no idea that NASA, A, was going to find ruins on the moon, and then B, they were going to cover them up. And I mean, just kind of give us a few minutes on how you wound up being a very singular person in a very singular exploration.
Oh, okay. Actually, I'd like to go back a little bit further because
sure.
The opportunity that there was a group of us at Boeing, where I was a flight instructor on 737s, that we called ourselves the Majestic 12, of course.
Uh-huh.
And before the days of digital and being able to send messages back and forth, we had to send, you know, typed copies and what that in the interoffice mail. Well, I got a notice from one of my friends that says, oh, this the guy that you got the book for, The Monuments of Mars, written by Richard C. Hoagland, and he's going to be here in town tonight. And I said, well, I don't have any students, so I'm going to go down and see this gentleman, maybe get him to autograph the book for me, because that kind of means something that I really got there. I went in to down by the big Space Needle there in Seattle and just walked in and walked up to the desk and going to pay my fees to go in and be able to watch the thing. And I decided I would give it a little letter of introduction so that because Richard had been making questions out into the public on the radio about people that might have information about the Apollo program that they've been saving. They need to come forward while it's still safe. Well, I asked the young lady there, I said, oh, well, would you give Mr. Hoagland this letter of introduction? She says, she picks it up, she's reading it, I'm watching her, and all of a sudden her hand starts to shake, and she says, don't move, you're who we've been looking for. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. So she rushes down the back, and next thing I know, Richard comes out from the back, and he looks at me, he says, okay, come down, sit on the front row, and we'll talk about it. And then the whole plan was the next morning he showed up at my house with, I think, you had a group of about seven people. And they started going through my archive, and some of the people were saying, oh, my God, would you look at this picture? I mean, it's 8x10, and the stuff that we've seen doesn't look anything at all like this. So, and in fact, that one of the interesting things, my wife was looking at some of them. Mind you, I'd had, this was 1995, as a matter of fact, on mm-hmm. May the 5th. And
God,
my wife
got the date down. Gosh.
Well, that was easy because you wrote it down on the inside of the book. Thank you. My wife and I hadn't paid that much attention to them because we'd kept them in a big safe and for safety. And
these are the photographs you'd archive, you'd save.
Right. The photographs, I had the 60-millimeter film strips. I had and I still have the 35-millimeter slides, positive transparencies. I have quite a collection that later on in history, getting down there, when they started trying to get rid of me and stuff, they said, oh, my God, he really does have the stuff. Anyway, the one to say right fast, my wife was looking at the pictures while Richard and his team were talking with me. And lo and behold, she says, what's this reflection in this astronaut's visor on the moon? And that was one of the first anomalies that we found, is my wife looking there. And there was the craft that was hovering above the Apollo 11 crew on the lunar surface. So,
Are you sure that was Apollo 11 or Apollo 12? Because there's a very anomalous thing that appears in Bean's helmet as a reflection on the Apollo 12 mission.
Well, I think we have both. Anyway, so that was that. Now, how I wound up with all of this good stuff into my archive, and I think you covered it there on the introduction, is it? As the director of the Data and Photo Control Department.
Well, hang on. Let's start to do this chronologically because we have the time. You know, 3 hours gives us the time. And minus a few minutes at the top and the bottom of the hour, which I'll give you a warning about. Let's go back to how you wound up getting involved in the space program. For that, we're going to have to go to Radio with Pictures. So everybody, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com. You click on that graphic for tonight's show with Steve and Ken. That will take you to the guest page. Scroll down till you see Ken Johnston's items. And there's a picture there, number one, showing a very – were we ever that young, Ken? There you are, a spit and polish Marine. My God.
I don't have that much hair left anymore. Okay. Yeah, mine's not nice and beautiful and white like yours is.
So anyway, there's that picture. And below it is a photograph, an aerial photograph of the NASA Manned Spacecraft Center, later changed and named to the Lyndon Johnson Space Center after the president, who basically was responsible for getting it set up there in Texas. And there it says before the LRL, how did you wind up at NASA? And then how did you wind up at this place called the LRL, which we'll describe in a few minutes?
All right. After finishing up my basic flight training, and we were going into the jet training portion there, this was at the beginning of the really push towards in Vietnam. The Commandant of the Marine Corps sent down a message that all Marines will now become helicopter pilots. Well, my dad had been a pilot and a bomber pilot during World War II and lost his life in that. And there was no way that I was going to fly an airplane that had a wing swinging around above it. I was going to be okay. It got down to the point where I had to make a decision. Did I want to stay in the Marine Corps? And I did what was called a DOR, drop at your own request. Now, I've been attacked by old James Olberg saying, oh, he was dismissed, he was fired, or he dropped out. You know, that's garbage, because that's his whole job is to try to debunk and refute my credentials, which fortunately I've kept all these years, and we've got proof, so he can just go pound sand in a rat hole. It's not going to work. Okay, so... I left the Marine Corps in 1966. My brother, Dr. A.R. Johnston, was an employee, a scientist, engineer with NASA at the Johnson Space Center. And he says, well, why don't you get yourself down here real fast, because we're teaming up for the Apollo program now. We're finishing up the end of Gemini. And so I took my new family and we raced down to Houston. And the next day I went in and applied for jobs at Grumman and at BRN and Rockwell and TRW, all of the big ones. And I got offers from all of them.
Wow.
But I wanted to be involved with the actual testing and of the spacecraft. So Grumman was looking for, civilian astronauts, consultant type pilots, where our job was to be able to communicate with the engineers and scientists with Grumman to be sure that the systems would work well as well, and then turn around and help teach the astronauts. One of the things in the announcement said that it was a simulator. No, we didn't do the simulator part. We actually were using LTA-8 and doing our testing inside the actual spacecraft that was man-rated for a vacuum of space and could have gone to the moon.
Wow.
All right. So we did all the testing and we finished up. Once Apollo 11 flew, Grumman was stuck with too many people. Say they laid off 30,000 employees coast to coast in the United States that had been helping to build. And President Nixon, he says, you know, we're not going research and development to the moon. We're flying routine flights to the moon, so we don't need all of these other people. So we got laid off. And I had been in New York watching the Apollo 11 landing. And once I got home, I was ready to go to work on the Skylab with Grumman, because we were going to hook a lunar module ascent stage up to the Skylab with a Hubble telescope attached to the back of it. Well, since the budget got cut, my project got ended. I got laid off from there. But as fate would have it, I went over to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, the LRL, and was immediately hired by Brown & Root Northrop. And I wound up taking over from one of the chief scientists there. Had been trying to run the business and the photos and the records and everything else while they were doing the sample evaluations.
Okay, so, hang on. Let's stop here and tell people, what was the Lunar Receiving Laboratory? What did it receive?
Okay, when the first, Apollo 11, Apollo 12, would have been 13, didn't make it, and Apollo 14, those first four missions to the moon, when they got back to Earth, they had to go be put in quarantine for at least 22 days.
Oh, I remember, yes. And their brilliant silver trailer, their Airstream trailer.
That was on board the aircraft carriers that usually would pick up the command module once it re-entered the Earth and splashed down in the Pacific. Okay, so they would bring the Airstream and hook up to the back of the LRL and go through an airlock and into the quarantine area where it had a reduced pressure compared to the outside, so that nothing on the inside would be able to escape through the windows or holes.
So by having reduced pressure, the outside atmosphere would press the outside air in, but correct, inside air couldn't get out.
Absolutely. And so that was our way of trying to quarantine and protect us on the planet Earth from anything horrible that might come from the moon.
So this quarantine facility there was what, like a whole apartment complex in the Lunar Receiving Lab?
Absolutely. It had rooms and kitchens and places for playing games and relaxation, as well as a research laboratory. And we had huge glass windows all along one area where people could come in and talk to their loved ones, as well as have conferences with the astronauts that were in quarantine. And mind you, all three astronauts had to go into quarantine, whether they landed on the moon or not, such as Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and
Mike Collins.
Thank you. I'm having a moment
there. You're welcome.
Mike Collins, because once they finished on the moon and they lifted off the lunar surface and left the descent stage there, rendezvoused with the command module, docked, transferred all of the stuff, they were covered in lunar dust and dirt. So anything that Neil and Buzz or the other ones, the commander and the lunar module pilots, would bring back to the command modules, their dust would have contaminated the command module pilot, just the same as if he had been on the lunar surface.
As if he'd been down on the surface.
Absolutely.
So they breathed this dust in. Now, did the doctors notice any weird medical things? Because we now know that this lunar dust, this moon dust, raising a wonderful book by Arthur C. Clarke, remember A Fall of Moon Dust? It is composed of little tiny, sharp, jagged pieces of glass.
Yes, yes.
And so all the astronauts who went to the moon and all the command module pilots who didn't, who met the crew when they got back up into orbit, they all breathed this dust for days and days and days in a very small environment, the size of, a couple of phone booths. So there wasn't any way that the command module pilot could avoid either getting that in his lungs or, the worst case scenario, having some kind of alien Andromeda strain virus that would take over the Earth.
That's right. That's right. And that's the reason why we did the quarantine process, which only lasted for the first four flights. And then Apollo 15, 16, and 17 wasn't required to go into quarantine. Okay. So we would take all the lunar samples out, take them to the building next door, where they'd be put inside of a processing laboratory, where they could then separate them and get them dust off and clean them off and get them all set and ready so that they could be given to scientists that had requested samples from the moon to take back to their laboratories in the various places in the world and do the analysis. In addition, they would photograph the pictures as they did their analysis. Now, on the lunar surface, before they would pick up any of this samples, the astronauts with the Hasselblad camera, which was attached to the front part of the spacesuit, they would take pictures of each sample so that they had the orientation on the moon, as far as north, south, east, and west would be, the angle of the sun, the time of day, all of this on taking pictures, so that would be able to, the scientists would be able to take into consideration any type of solar radiation that might have been bombarding some of the samples. All right. Now, in order to provide those samples and the information, the analysis that was done, to the scientists, it had to go through the data and photo control department, which I was the director of.
Now, hang on. Just so we're very, very clear, because people don't understand the bureaucracies. I mean, who understands government bureaucracies? You were not a, quote, NASA employee.
That is correct.
You were what is called a subcontractor through private corporation called Brown & Root, major engineering firm. They build things all over the world. They had the contract from NASA to run the lunar receiving laboratory, analyzing, looking at, parceling out the samples that the astronauts brought back from the moon, right?
That is correct. And also they were maintaining the maintenance of the complete manned spacecraft center there in Houston. And that was their primary contract.
Oh, so that's how they got the LRR contract. They were in charge of the whole damn fandamily, as my grandmother would say.
That's totally right. Absolutely. Okay. So
they built in that aerial photograph that we have as number two in your section. That aerial photograph is looking at construction totally done by Brown & Root, this major construction company.
Well, they would be the primary contractor in charge, and then they in turn would have subcontractors.
With subcontract, et cetera.
They would do the work. Correct.
Yes.
It was a complete hierarchy. Okay. Anyway, so in order to be able to provide the information, the initial testing done, the lunar surface photography, and the samples themselves, it was my job to maintain enough of the photography to be able to get the information, because we would have scientists that engineers and scientists are terrible about keeping records and times. They might show up a day or two early or late. So I established my little department there to maintain five complete sets. Actually, it was six complete sets because I had one as a control of all the photos and videos and mission reports that were done on each one of the missions, so that whenever a scientist showed up, I could give them a whole complete package. Well, after Apollo, I was there through Apollo 14, my immediate supervisor with, I guess it was Brown Northrop, came in. That was Bud Lascala. He says, Ken, need to get rid of all of those extra pictures. We don't need them anymore. And I said,
Wait. Hang on.
Okay. All right.
You've been working on what, three missions?
Yep.
And this is at the end of Apollo 14 before you left the Lunar Receiving Lab, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And all you had archived duplicates, backups. You'd done all the mission cataloging. You were sending out photographs of the samples to scientists all over the world per NASA.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, I had a very nice letter from what is his name here? Well, not Mo Roth. I was looking inside my book real fast for commendation for doing such a good job, better than what the scientists had been doing it before him. So, you know, I've got proof that at least I did my job right. Anyway, so Bud says, we need to get rid of all of those things. You just don't need them. And I said, well, let me send them to universities that have a science fair. They would let me. After all, we paid for it with our tax dollars. And he argued with me back and forth, got to get rid of this, get rid of that. I said, well, wait. He says, I don't care what you do, just get rid of them and keep one. I said, okay. And well, that was a little tacit approval. So I did.
Hang on. So yep. He told you to get rid of all of them except one set
that is
for
correct.
The Lunar Receiving Laboratory.
That is
and
correct.
You interpreted very loosely, keep one as keep one for yourself.
Oh, he didn't tell me to do that. Of course not.
No, of course not.
No. Anyway, so I took, and mind you, three sets, and we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pictures, 8x10s and in color, as well as black and white and reels and stuff, out to the Dempsey dumpster right out behind the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, right off the little docking area where the garbage truck would come in. And I dumped them in there. And as a little side note, decades later, a wonderful friend and person we've come to know, and Donna Hare, had gone by there. It was either her or a friend of her saw the pictures and she saved a bunch of the pictures herself.
But
that's where hers came from, was out of the ones that I tossed into the dumpster.
Oh, now, my God.
The one that I kept, one complete set, there at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory as the control there. In the meantime, I had been keeping a complete set that I was going to, you know, use at home or use for my own personal use, what have you. So those went into my filing cabinet at home, and actually I wound up few years later, back then, right about the time I met you. And that's when I had that 2,000-pound safe, double door safe where I kept all that stuff in. Now I've got a good solid safe. Everything is still safe, but moving it from Seattle was kind of expensive to move a big safe like that.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. I actually blew past the break. Keith just reminded me.
Thank you.
Because this is riveting. I mean, this is really important stuff. So everyone hold it where you are. We'll bring Steve on in a moment to kind of, you know, dovetail his story with this story. I mean, this is really interesting. They told you actually to destroy, not to give to libraries or give to kids or send to colleges or whatever, but to destroy set after set after set of duplicate photographs made from the originals so no one could ever see them. Your NASA at work. We shall return. And welcome back on this Saturday night to the other side of midnight, rolling along here on the Great Celestial Highway. You know, we had a lunar eclipse a few days ago, and I'm going to talk more extensively about that tomorrow night. There's a whole bunch of links up in my section of the other side of midnight. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on the graphic, that will take you to the guest page tonight and scroll down. We're going to, as the morning progresses, we're going to kind of dip into some of those links, and I'll tell you why they're important for you to take a look at. But let's get back now to Ken and his story. So your boss tells you to destroy everything archived in the lab that's a duplicate except for one set. And he says kind of, you know, nonchalantly, keep one. And instead of giving you the option to send it to a school or universities or libraries or just kind of hand it out on the street, he has you take it outside and put all these priceless images of humankind's first visit in the modern era to the moon in a dumpster. That's nuts.
That's correct. Exactly what I followed orders as best I understood his orders. Let me throw something in here real fast, though, because I'm going to give my mother the credit for that, because she always said if it's something is important to you that might be important later on, keep it, because you'll never know when you might need it. For instance, I was talking about my nemesis. Oh, he said, he was just a technician. He didn't do anything, blah, blah. Well, this is the letter from in the Johnson Space Center from Dr. Jeffrey Warner, who was the chief scientist of the Lunar Receiving Laboratory and all the last sample processing. He says, I have completed a thorough review and inspection of the data and photo control facilities in room 105 at the LRL being run by Ken Johnston. I find that it is in very good shape. It is in order of magnitude better than when I left it. I think if that says enough by itself right there, that at least, you know, more than what my debunker is trying to put me in a hole, but that's the way his job was put on him by Dr. Thornton Page. And I think he's still trying to do that, but he's been warned to back off because I kept all the records. And so I'm really glad that I did.
Well, now, as my grandmother used to say, being a pack rat does have some advantages.
Hey, and I can attest to that for a fact. I've been over and I've seen your rows and rows of filing cabinets before. So we're in the same boat together.
That's ancient. That's old school. That's so retro. Everything now is be put on digital. The problem is when it's on digital, one bit and you can't get to it.
I have the same problem. The same problem. Now, we finished up talking about getting how I came about my archive, as it's become known. And as the space program started winding down, I went outside and went to work for Transamerica Corporation and was running one of the branch offices as they brought in for real estate there throughout the whole Houston area. And then they had an announcement they needed more astronauts for the new Skylab program. And as an idiot, I guess, I don't know. I always dreamed that I was going to be going into space. Most of my dream wasn't to go to the moon. It was always been Mars and still is. But anyway, I went back.
I had an old friend who actually became a NASA astronaut. Of course, his name is escaping me at the moment. But he was picked, Brian O'Leary. He was picked as the crop of astronauts that was someday going to go to Mars.
He was picked. Then Skylab first.
And then he found out that wasn't going to happen, and that's why he quit.
40 years later.
Yep.
He still looks like he's in good shape. Okay.
If we go back to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on the guest page, scroll down to item number 3, we have your actual letter from NASA accepting you for a potential astronaut position. Describe that, please.
Well, let me see. I'm looking at it myself right now. Okay. Oh, yeah. This was when I applied for one of the astronauts, and they thanked me for my application and all.
November 6, 1979.
Right. And I had letters of recommendation from Neil Armstrong and Jack Swigert and Jim Irwin recommending me for it. And they all said I was a shoo-in, but right about that time is when the government gets involved. You know what happens when the government gets involved? Yeah. Well, they decided they didn't want to have, as quote, jet jocks. They wanted to have PhD scientists. And I only had three bachelor's degrees and three bachelor's degrees at the time. So they dropped me from that list. Now, the same thing happened decades later for the Mars One Corporation. And I'll throw this in. We'll go back. You mind if I jump ahead and then come back?
No, go ahead.
Okay. They were looking for people that had prior astronaut training, and here I show up and put in my application. Oh, they thought it was great. They sent me to Switzerland and Poland and all over the United States promoting the Mars One program to send a group of astronauts to Mars one way. One way. And my wife signed me up for that, by the way. actually, after we had – for 2 years I had gone all over the world promoting the program, and then all of a sudden they went from 202,586 applicants that were willing to go one way, got it down to 1,000, and I'm still running in the top of the list, and then they drop it down to the final 100, which are going to go into training, and my name was dropped from the list.
Ah.
And my friends and I, Brett Shepard, and I went and checked all the ages and stuff, and it wound up they didn't take anybody above 60. They were all younger than that. And at the time I had just turned 70. I like to tell everybody, if you know what dyslexia is, right? So I'm only 57 now. So I still have an opportunity maybe to go 75. I'll be honest, if you don't know your math. Okay. Anyway, so,
I was saying to you the other day, you still may get there, and I may too, because there's a whole new era of private spaceflight. Look what Elon Musk is doing.
Absolutely.
And I have a feeling that the private sector will be a little more, shall we say, can I say this on the radio? Liberal with the requirements, so that you and I will both get to go. But you see, if it's done that way, if it's done by means of the technology that I think we're going to be seeing, it's not going to be rockets at all. It's right. going to be something that basically is real space propulsion, a real space drive, and you'll lift off like a feather, float out of the atmosphere into space. And of course, as Heinlein said, once you're in Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. And we can be in the moon and back before dinner, given the technology which is on the horizon. Based on the technology which is actually here right now that nobody except Mike Gamble the other night wanted to talk about publicly, which Boeing, good old Boeing, apparently has been working on for decades and has deployed in operationals. Ken, I did not know that we have basically anti-gravity drives in certain communication satellites in Earth orbit that Boeing has been working on for decades.
It's amazing how they can keep secrets, isn't it? It's amazing.
It sure is.
So now it's something you may not be aware of, but then there's been a lot of other activity going on with contact with those that, let's say, have been using that type of devices to keep pace of what's been going on with these little earthlings here on this planet for a long time. And I'm calling it the time for full disclosure, and it's starting to happen around the world. So you're going to see perhaps you and I can go and be there in a few minutes and go check out how things look on Mars instead of going to the moon first. Let's say, as you would say, Captain, how about warp factor 4, Commander?
Well, this isn't warp. This is, you know, inertia and mass and all that will operate, and it will take you hours to get to the moon and days to get to Mars and get home. But it sure beats 3 days for Apollo coasting and 9 months one way to get to Mars when Mars is in the position where you can get to it.
That's correct. That is correct. All right. Now, back to the main area here. So I wound up with my own archive, and I had kept them. Hadn't even paid that much attention to them because I would had a whole new career with a Boeing company as a flight instructor, and primarily on the 737s. I had students from all over the world, and it was an interesting experience because having worked at NASA and scientists from all over the world, for instance, I had the Chinese CAAC, which is the same as our FAA in America, and we had to have 100% translators that would translate everything we say to the students. And I had the director of the CAAC there. And so after the first hour and 15 minutes, we're getting ready to take a break. And the director comes up and gets the translator to ask me some questions such as like, how do you like working with people, other nationalities, races, and other countries? Mm. And I looked at him, sort of smiled. I looked at the translator. I said, translate this absolutely as close and best as you can. And I'm looking at the director. I said, you know, I like everybody. I don't care what their race, religion, creed, or color is, but I don't like assholes no matter what their race, religion, creed, or color is. He broke into a laugh and gave me a hug, and the translator said, we would have been friends wherever we met. So that wow. just gives you an idea. As humans, I think that I'm one of the few people that perhaps is as a solar system ambassador at once for NASA. That I would make an excellent solar system ambassador for extraterrestrials to continue working with the humans. Okay. Now, what's the next part of this? Oh, that was it. Now, since I had my records and my archive, and I went to your big show about the Monuments of Mars there in Seattle, and I got there and I got your autograph on it. You guys showed up. And so the story of Ken's archive had not been known to the world at that time. And correct me if I'm wrong, you said, you know, we need to get you public fast before they find out and something happens to you. So the very next day, you guys sent me to Oklahoma City and Oklahoma University, and I went there to recover the majority of the other part of the archive and bring it back to us. And then the week later, we went to Washington, D.C. to the press club, the International Press Club, where you had myself and a couple of the others. We came public and we told the world about some of the things that we found on the moon that NASA had not let other people know. Now, shall I go a little further on that one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And this was an awesome experience for me there in Washington, D.C. And one of the slides and things that we showed them is now, as the director of the Data and Photo Control Department, I became very good friends with Dr. Thornton Page, who was the chief scientist in charge of not only the NASA scientists, but then other scientists would come visit. He came to my little data and photo control office and he says, Ken, would you pull the 16-millimeter film from the Apollo 14 last mission and gave me the number that I'd have to check it out from the main photo lab. And he said, set up a showing for me and some of my my guests. And so I did. I went and picked it up, got it all set up. And right next door to the mission control is building 7, if my memory is right. And the first floor in the big conference room, I had it set up a 16 millimeter film for gun sight camera projection. And the only difference there with your gun sight cameras, if you've ever seen movies where an airplane is in a dogfight with another and you see these little tracers squirting out and looking like they're shooting at each other, well, that's a gun sequence camera that takes one frame, you know, every millisecond or what have you. So I set the reels up and I have it running now, and it shows the command module. No, wait a minute. It shows the lunar module going around to the backside of the moon, approaching one of the larger craters. And for people who don't know, Russia got to the moon first with their satellites, and they, on the backside, people call it the dark side, but it's the backside, and they were taking pictures, and all the craters of a certain size, they were given Russian scientists and very ancient historical characters of Russia. They named the craters after them, such as the crater Tsiolkovsky. Well, the film is showing the spacecraft approaching Tsiolkovsky, and this particular sun angle on that day was such that probably about a third of the bottom of the crater was in shadow. And as we're approaching it, in that shadowed area, there's this cluster of illuminated domes. Now, I've described this many times to people. If you'll take your hand and put your palm up, and then you fold all your fingers, if you still have them all, five of them, you've got to be absolutely correct, because otherwise somebody will say you're telling a story. You're lying. You know what I'm talking about. So you look down at the top of the ball tops of your fingers all together there, and that's the way those five were clustered together. And one of them, the closest to the rim of the crater, had a steam column coming up from it. Dr. Page says, okay, freeze it. Okay, back up, approach again. And with the gun sequence camera projector, that's what I could do. I could go frame by frame by frame. And once I got close, we went frame by frame. And he had me stop. And we were all looking at these. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, we have found an alien base, or a base on the moon. At the time, everything was alien. We weren't even just first time going to the moon. This was Apollo 14. He turns to the other seven.
This was in 1971.
Yes, that's correct. So he turns to the other scientists, about seven of them, and he says, well, boys, what do you think of that? And they all just crack out laughing, because it's like they knew in advance. Well, obviously he knew, or he wouldn't have had
it. Oh, it was like an in-joke, an inside joke. And yes, you were the, as George Gobel said on Johnny Carson one night, you were the pair of brown shoes at the wedding.
But I think I was being tested later on. I've discovered this since I actually been involved with you, because the next day I was told to pull that same reel of film and take it to the main auditorium, and during the lunch hour, show it to the rank and file personnel at the Johnson Space Center. And well, okay, I took that reel back and then checked it back in the photo lab. The next morning I went over, I checked it out, and at noon I took it over to the auditorium, set it all up. I had my brother, Dr. A.R. Johnston, in the projection booth with me, and I had saved it and hadn't told anybody, because I wanted to have the experience of seeing their excitement to see what we had just looked at the day before. So we're approaching Tsiolkovsky Crater, and there it is, and there's the center of it. You can see some of the mountains that stick up in the middle of a crater from the impact. And over in the right-hand side in the shaded area, there was nothing there.
What?
There was nothing there. I stopped the camera.
Now, wait, hang on. Yep. This is the era of analog film.
Correct. Absolutely.
You're looking at film that was shot by a Mauer gun camera borrowed from military, put on Apollo, taken to the moon,
right,
in lunar orbit, looking out the window of the command and lunar modules, taking imagery frame by frame, either 24 frames or 16 or 5 or whatever per second,
right,
as a piece of physical movie film that you put in a projector and run not on a computer but in a projector bouncing off a screen.
Right.
And in the 24 hours between, correct, you showing Paige that first piece of film,
yes,
the same film you checked out of the library 24 hours later, nothing that you saw in Tsiolkovsky is there.
Well, let's say I thought it was the same one, because I stopped the camera and I told the audience, and I said, we're having some technical difficulties. Be with you in just a moment. I took the film out. I had my gloves on, and I started thumbing through, or, you know, stretching it through like you've seen Hollywood people do with film strips.
Projectionists, yeah.
Thank you.
Looking at it frame by frame up against the light.
There was no evidence of any of the holes in the sprockets and or anything with that showed that it had been tampered with. Okay, I put it all back in, and I continued. And the audience, they were excited. They were happy because they were getting a chance to look at, you know, Tsiolkovsky Crater and some of the others on the backside of the moon. It was fascinating to them. But here I am in absolute distraught, because I thought we were ready to expose to the world that there was evidence of someone, something, or people, whatever, on the moon, because we had pictures of it, even with that column of steam. Okay, so I took the film back to the photo lab, checked it in. As I'm walking out, as fate would have it, Dr. Thornton Page was on his way walking back to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. Now, just for the people who are using television right now watching us, which we're not, Dr. Thornton Page had lost an eye when he was much younger, and he wore a patch like a pirate. And this,
a black this, pirate. I worked with Thornton Page separately on another project.
Yeah.
And now I'm thinking what happened on my project with him was the same thing that happened on your project with him.
See, let me finish this here. Dr. Page, I said, Dr. Page, what happened to those domes and things that we saw in Tsiolkovsky? He looked at me, and with the patch on, he took the other eye and he held it shut for a moment, brought it back. He winked at me. He said, there was never anything there. And now, mind you, we were on, this was Apollo 14, and we were such a pace to keep up with the program schedule to get the other missions to the moon and what have you, that, you know, I thought, well, I'll get back and check this out another time. Well, as fate would have it, I got laid off at BRN. I went over to the spacesuit company and worked with them for a while. So it's amazing how I think now I've looked back and I think I was being tested by Dr. Page and them. Could I keep the secrets that they had to keep in there? And as it is, the answer is no. If we paid for it with our money and it belongs to all of us, dadgummit, I'm going to talk about it. So, you know, that kind of got me in trouble there. All right. So now we know that.
Hang on just 1 second. I've been typing to Kinthea on the Skype window because we have this back channel communication. She's not answering. So, Kinthea, if you look in the Skype window, I've got a composite image to put in Ken's section at the very bottom, which we'll pick up in the next segment, the next half hour, at the top of the hour. We really need that up there so that we can talk about it. Sorry, Ken.
That's okay. Let's see. What was going to happen next? It's amazing.
Well, you left Brown and Root. You left the LRL. You're kind of floating around Houston trying to find another job at another aerospace company.
Yeah, and I did. I went to work with the company that builds the spacesuits for all of the different missions and things like that. And I became
ILC.
ILC.
Out of Dover, Delaware.
You know what ILC stands for?
No.
International Latex Corporation.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
You know what they make for the rest of the people in the world? Girdles and bras. And they build good spacesuits, okay?
Well, I've seen the images, you know, the film, because it was all film in those days, of these literally little old ladies.
Yeah.
Over these tables with needles in their hands, sewing the spacesuits by hand, layer after layer after layer. I mean, those spacesuits had what, like 15 or 20 layers?
Yes, they did.
Amazing. Amazing handiwork. Talk about a cottage industry.
They could withstand micrometeorite impacts, and that was what was important. And I lost – let me tell the audience right fast. If you ever use a – cell phone and text messaging while you're driving, I'll tell you what it will do. My wife was driving. I was the passenger in the car. This was last year on April the 6th, and we stopped at a T intersection, and this gal rear ends us doing about 40 miles an hour. Mm. And I was sitting forward looking like a good husband who's helping the wife drive. I'm looking at the cars coming to be sure she doesn't run into them. So thank God my wife stopped, put the car in park. Then we got rear-ended, or we would have been shoved into these cars moving. And the problem, I've had MRIs done and stuff. There was a tiny bit of leakage in my brain area, which has caused me to have lapse of short-term memory. So while I'm talking, if all of a sudden I'll go blank, I may revert to you, Richard, and say, okay, what was I just talking about? Because as soon as I get told that, then it triggers the thought, and I can keep going. We're going into some super diets for brain food and stuff that's supposed to help restore the dendrites and synapses, et cetera, and help me grow some new brain cells. It's a terrible thing, as active as I have been and still am, even with Civil Air Patrol as a lieutenant colonel with cadets and all, to be stuck with a thing and all of a sudden it drops out. So that's my apology if I go blank on you for a moment, and now I'm back into where we were.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a break anywhere at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Ken Johnston, and we're talking about his experiences during the Apollo missions and what happened with his experiences in NASA afterwards. We'll return to Ken at the after the break at the top of the hour. We'll also bring on Steve Troy. We got a lot of show to go. It's only 1 hour. We got 2 hours to go, plus your questions on Blog Talk, and I'll give you that number right now. You can write it down, 917-889-8802. That's 917 888-989-8802. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard Z. Hoagland, and we shall return. Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll have access to a private chat server that members use to chat about the show during the show, and you will have a direct channel to post a question that will be read on the air to the guest. And you'll have a place to post questions during our open hailing frequencies. We realize that not everyone wants to call in live, and this gives you an easy way to participate in a live show without having to participate. Club 19.5 members can use this private chat to talk about the shows, ask questions, suggest new guests, and I may even pop on from time to time to answer specific questions. Also, the entire Bridge crew is in these participating chat channels, so you can interact with them as well. You'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members because without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out.